focused on evaluating some real asset managers and real estate managers. The goal today is to select some folks that are going to help us put 5% hedge on inflation in our portfolio. That's essentially what we're trying to do today, create inflation hedges in our portfolio. So with that, I will turn the meeting over to Tim Price, and then he can tell us who gets to share the floor with him.
Thank you. And I'm actually going to let Milliman do the introductions again here, but just a quick overview. This is the second half of our real asset mandate. This is the private half. You're going to hear from three managers that were selected today a couple of weeks ago, Aether, BlackRock, and Common Fund. Keep in mind, these are all private allocations. It does tend to look like a private equity structure where we lock up the money for anywhere between 7 and 12 years. You have the option of going with any one of the three or any combination thereof. Keep in mind that you are not required to deploy any capital today. This is if there is a comfort level, because this is very long-term lockup capital, so we have a very pretty high bar for who we're going to work with today. We do think there's some very credible firms in the room, but as always in the private structure space, this is who is available or in the market currently, and we can always come back to you in another 6 to 12 months, and we will come back to you regardless in another 6 to 12 months with follow-on funds. So treat this as the first round of a long build-out process. We'll let Milliman do the introduction of the firms.
I'd like to second what Tim just said, in that if you don't feel comfortable with these firms, or if you don't feel comfortable with allocating the full 150, there is absolutely no need that you have to do that. You can give less or nothing if that's the way it goes. We expect that you will find one or more of these firms that you do want to invest with. We have, along with staff, we have met with all three of these firms since the last meeting to do some enhanced due diligence. Common Fund was here, and I was here for that meeting, and both Marty and Jeff represented us at meetings at Aether and at BlackRock. BlackRock was out here as well. So going briefly to review the report, this looks a lot like the semi-finalist report, except that we're pretty much down to the three finalists here. And just to review, you're hoping to get some relief from possible inflation, which may occur at some point. This is a real asset search, and real assets are expected to do differently than financial assets in an unexpected inflation environment. So it gives you additional diversification, helps you fund your COLA, and we think it's a good idea, and it was a result of the asset allocation study that we did some time ago. Again, we're looking for $150 million. The three firms are Aether, Common Fund, and BlackRock. We at one point expected to have four firms come in here. Three is kind of a narrow session, but that's the way it worked out. Aether is the smallest of the three funds, and maybe I'll let you talk about the trip to Denver.
Sure. Marilyn and I visited Aether at their offices in Denver last week. Like Tim said, with these managers, because it's a new mandate, it's something that you haven't done before. We wanted to make trips to check everything out. When you go to Aether's offices, there's actually five people there. Troy and Sean are the two main people. They're the real asset portfolio managers. They've done it at previous firms. There's actually a pretty small community of people who have done private real asset investing nationwide. They all seem to kind of know each other. Troy and Sean run the firm. They run it as a firm they want to keep small. All the back office accounting is outsourced. It allows them to really focus on the firm, but it is small. With that, there's underneath Troy and Sean are three analysts that go through a program. They work for them for 2 years, 3 years, go to business school, maybe invited back. They don't plan to grow this firm to anything greater than 5 to 10 analysts, with Troy and Sean still being the heads of the operation. So it's small, it's designed that way, but we do feel that they're definitely experts in this field, but we'd want you to get some comfort with both the two heads, Troy and Sean, today as they present.
Seed investors in Aether include the firm that the new head of WHV was previously at, so that's kind of an interesting connection. Another seed investor was the head guy at a firm called Arbor Capital. And one of the interesting points that came up in the meeting, I guess, was that the two head guys work out of different offices. So that's an interesting question.
Troy works out of an office in Seattle, and Sean works in Denver with the rest of the team. Troy is effectively in the office in Denver. They have a live feed. He's on a TV there, so they can watch each other so he does some work. But that is something to know. The other thing here is that this is, Aether is, as a firm, dedicated exclusively to private real asset investing. The other firms that we're talking to today, BlackRock has a big private equity program. Real asset program would be a part of that. Common Fund is another big asset management firm. Private real assets is a part of that. This is for Aether. It is all they do. And so they kind of stake everything on the success of their funds. But they can be more hyper-focused in this particular space.
Which has its pluses and minuses. They're the most, they have the most invested in this thing working. On the other hand, if this thing doesn't work, that's pretty much what it is. So with that, we wish you well in your choices.
I had a quick question.
Yeah.
Gabe and then Jerry. And
why is the one person in Seattle? Is it just where he lives, his family?
His wife moved. Well, he moved his family to Denver. His wife decided that she really needed to be close to family in Seattle. It's interesting. They all sit in one big room. There's not individual offices. There's one big trading desk, and there's a TV on the wall with a live feed and microphones built into the desk. Quite frankly, they see him more often via that video screen than I've seen a lot of other firms have interaction with, you know, people who sit next door to each other. It's unorthodox, but it seems to work for them.
Even though they're not communicating, just working, he's still on the screen.
They're on a live audio and video feed. They're just talking to each other.
So the guy's always sitting there. So if you were in different offices, like a lot of firms are, you see a lot less of people.
Yeah. There's probably no more boring TV you could watch set up there. But one thing that should be mentioned too: these guys are traveling a lot to visit the various, you know, investments. So even though office-wise they're in separate offices, they're on the road together often. So they do see each other. It's not just a 9-to-5. You're piped in via TV type thing.
Jerry, and then Jerry.
This is not a question I want to pose to the BlackRock folks, but instead to you, because you wrote this. In the cons on BlackRock, there's a statement here I read several times. I can't make heads or tails of it. It basically says it's a custom portfolio, so there's no track record. I get it, but could the author explain to me what the track record? It's not available, and a track record is not at risk should results be poor. What does that mean?
If
a track record,
if you're
is not
Aether,
at risk.
If you're Aether, this is going to determine whether you get hired for new stuff. This is your track record, and people are going to look at your track record, like we're going to look at Invesco and Long Wharf later, and say, how have they done? Since this is kind of a custom product put together for us, they don't have to include it in a composite. They don't have to include it in their marketing going forward.
It doesn't determine the success or failure of the program. If it's successful, they'll probably broadly market it. If it's not successful, it's not really public information.
This is a BlackRock reference.
Right.
Okay.
But BlackRock overall is in the top 25% top, right?
BlackRock, well, depends on the product set.
I mean, as a company.
The Bar Rosenberg, you may remember him before he was the guru before he got tarnished. And he said the way people do it is they, he was using beta, but he said you set up eight portfolios, four with high beta, four with low beta. And after a year, you see which one, whether the high betas or the low betas did well. And you throw away the low beta, the ones that didn't do well. And then you do the same thing again. And after 4 years, you have the greatest manager in the world, which is the one that lasted through the mm-hmm. cuts. Mm-hmm. The and not a bad strategy. And if you're BlackRock, you yours, like Tim said, can either be a one they carry forward to clients, or well, that didn't really fit in the composite because it was a special portfolio, and that's what it means. We, in no way are we saying that they won't do their best, but it's not as important to them as it would be to either.
As I looked at companies that didn't have a track record but had an offering, my concern was, well, they don't really have a record that they could assign a junior person, in theory, to your portfolio and have it not do very well and not have any consequences. But as we met with BlackRock, they have a pretty robust process as things go through. I don't think that is very likely to happen there. But it could. It could happen at a firm where, you know, they just assign you to the new person that's been hired and you have this nightmare and there are no consequences. I do not think that's going to happen at BlackRock. They seem very credible. They have a very discipline process that all investments go through.
So the reference to risk not being, a track record not being as a risk, it's a risk to BlackRock,
right.
not
right.
to us.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
If you invest with BlackRock and you're their first completely private, yeah.
I was spinning that around. I was trying to figure out that somehow wasn't a risk to us.
That's what it would mean.
No. Well, it might be a risk to you if they weren't paying close attention and didn't have something at stake. But
thank you.
Gary?
Yeah, on page 13, up on the top, it says that with ARA 1, they had 109 investors. ARA 2, they had 193 investors. And and we're going to ARA 3, from what I assume, if we accept this. And its expected number of investors is 125. Do you know how many of those are reinvestors from 1 and 2?
They mentioned that somewhere between 50 and 60% roll over. Not to mention, though they don't make up the bulk of the fund, but the owners have their entire net worth
in
their fund. So.
Page 14, number 23, the last line. The fund will invest primarily in illiquid vehicles pursuing private investments in real assets. That's not clear to me. What typically are they, or what specifically are they referring to?
This is a fund of funds. Okay. So it's illiquid private equity, private real asset funds that they're investing in.
So the underlying funds are going to focus on energy, metals and mining, timber, ag, that sort of thing.
Yeah, sure.
So that's what, so.
That's the same with all.
Natural gas reserves, metal and mineral reserves, agricultural land and timberland.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's what is referred to as illiquid.
Illiquid, of course, means that it's a private equity fund. You get in and you're there. It's not one of these things that trades on the stock market and you can get out of easily. But once you're in, you're in.
But Jerry, you do bring up an interesting point there. The fact that it's illiquid, there is a preference, at least from staff, that there's an interim cash flow. So I would like this to not look purely like a private equity strategy where we send over money, the money gets invested, we don't see a dime until something is sold 7 years later. To the extent possible, if there's an interim cash flow, and it can be modest, but if there's an interim cash flow that is somewhat tied to the inflation, and so as inflation moves, the interim cash flow is moving, and those can be rental payments coming off the underlying funds, if it's a utility, timber sales from a timber fund. There is a preference for that cash flow to come through, and you can feel free to quiz all three firms today on that.
Yeah. Okay. And that being said, we do have real assets liquid also.
We have the entire 5% is currently invested in liquid real assets with the expectation that we draw down about half of that over time.
Right.
And you'll notice we're not talking about overcommitment today. We're talking about $150 million because we do want to build this out over a number of years here. So these are private investments that you will be talking about an overcommitment at some point in order to get up to our target.
Just like
this is an initial allocation. We're not betting the farm here.
This is like how you do real estate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I can say, on valuation, notwithstanding the fact that it's so liquid, once a quarter we get valuation numbers from them. I assume that if we really needed to, we would start with those valuation numbers in terms of attempting to negotiate to sell our interest or part of it back. How does that work, and how do they determine those valuation numbers when there is no value?
There is a secondary market in these kind of funds, but it's relatively small, and you would expect to take a large haircut. You've done a lot of private equity and real estate closed-end funds over the years, and you've never liquidated one. It's an interesting question of interim valuations, and there was a huge scandal some years back where real estate funds kept their valuations too high. They didn't write them down quick enough, and public employees of Idaho and Paul Sather came out with a paper arguing that these valuations were way too high, and there was a big to-do about it, and they got written down. People generally do a pretty good job of valuing those funds. If you did want to sell out, you'd want to very carefully check all those valuations. The reason we tend to focus on the internal rates of return on our report in the quarterly is because those interim valuations are accepted to be approximations.
And like, I certainly understand that if your only buyer there's a small market out there somewhere, you're valuing it at 100, and the alternative buyer is valuing it at 30. At what point do we get uncomfort? Who is it that develops that comfort level?
Every one of these firms is going to have an outside auditor to come in and do valuation work. So look for a name brand auditor, Deloitte & Touche, Ernst & Young, to come in and provide that. That's a fair market value. That doesn't mean that's a transactional value. And when you get in transactional issues, you don't sell these unless you're a forced seller. Therefore, it's always fire sale pricing if you're selling on the secondary market.
You may recall you own a secondary fund from Adam Street. And you've made some really good money in that secondary fund because they were able to pick off distressed sellers.
We want to get to a scenario where there's really no reason we should ever have to sell these. We should never have a liquidity crunch internally. And there might be a bad fund in here, but if there's a bad fund, quite frankly, there's no resale value to it, and that can happen. But we really want to think of this as long-term capital. We want to capture the premium associated with locking up our capital for 7 to 12 years. We're expecting to earn a premium over what we can get in the public markets of about 2% per year annualized. And that's really the mindset we kind of have to go in with these.
And if you're a forced seller, you might take a 25% discount or more.
Jerry?
Just a quick question. I may have never seen this reference before. I just don't recall seeing the reference. But on Common Fund, you indicate there are two observers to the investment process. A specific reference to observers. I've never seen that before. Is that people that they have veto power? Are they there just hanging out? Or
on the
what does that mean?
Committee?
On page 41, it says observers to the investment committee include.
Yeah, there are the two other senior managers that are senior level officers.
Yeah, but I've never seen that reference before where somebody's just kind of observer.
Well, it could mean they don't have a voting right, but they can certainly express their opinion. Sort of like, you know, an alternate member that may not accept. You usually give them a vote.
Watch your shots about alternate members.
I think it's the president of the firm and one other person who are like part of the investment committee, but they're not part of the private equity group. So they play a role in that. I don't know if they vote or not, but I know they're present. They're part of those decisions.
But they can give signals at the table.
Observers would kind of imply that they don't.
Hanging out was a good description.
Yeah, hanging out.
It's called social pressure.
Didn't that make that sense to the succession plan to show that the observers are there in case somebody moves out from the six seats that they do have?
Mm-hmm.
The observers there to move in and be acclimated already to what's going on?
Yeah.
That's okay. What I took from that.
I kind of had a question that was a big picture question, because when you look at each one of these firms, their energy component was like 40 to 70%, depending on who they were. What would be the difference between making a commitment to one of these firms and all our alternatives, which is the Energy Investor Fund?
Investor concentrates on power plants and pipelines and transmission lines. These are broader. Even within energy, they're broader.
Yeah, they get mining and timber.
It could be energy exploration. It could be natural gas field development. EIF is really build the plant, build the transmission line. It's that narrow focus of it.
Okay.
Within the managers that you'll talk to today, there's different, like you said, there's different levels of concentration. I think Common Fund is the highest.
Right.
That's something to take into account, too, that one firm may be heavier in one sector than another, but if you want broad, if you have real assets, you do want somebody who is not going to be over-concentrated necessarily in one area versus another.
Yeah, there's something a little more balanced about
right.
that.
Well, and you have flexibility with, like BlackRock, you have the option to
set it up the way you
set
want.
It up a little bit different.
Okay. All right.
I have one last.
Yes, Terry.
Out of these, which one would take more of a North America or U.S. bias the most?
Aether won't do more than 30% outside of the U.S.
Right. BlackRock was right in that category as well.
I think they're all pretty.
Common Fund might be a little bit more North American centric.
Yeah.
Slightly.
Well, because of the
it's not a huge differentiating factor. I think we're all in that kind of 70 to 100% range.
So what are the liability issues of investors for fracking if we get involved in Canada? Just want to ask. Where do we have to live with that? If they get sued, we get sued, investors get sued too?
I remember Energy Investors had a plant that they were constructing that blew up.
Right.
That was a lot worse than the fracking
okay.
danger that you're facing, I think.
All right. Okay.
I haven't seen
we didn't get sued there. I was pretty happy about that. Okay. All right, ready to go? We're going to see Aether first, I believe, a small firm.
Aether just seems like there's just no depth there. What's it? When you read their succession planning, it basically says, hey, but happens, it happens.
Find out.
I think I may ask them. Intrigued with Common Fund.
Well,
so
good morning.